Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CJAM's Handy Link. You're listening to Handy Link on CJAM 99.1 FM, reaching high ground in Windsor, Detroit.
Hello and welcome to Handy Link, sponsored by the Italian Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that provides recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. I'm your host, Cam Wells. In this segment of our show, we're going to hear from Estelle Benson and her associate Laura from the GBS Foundation. So tell me a little bit about the foundation's work.
Oh, thank you, Cam, for having us on your program. I'm Estelle Benson. I'm the founder of the organization. And 40 years ago, my husband had Guillain-Barré syndrome. Nobody had ever heard of it. There was no treatment. There was no information available. And to treat it, all they gave him was aspirin. And for pain, believe it or not, wine. And he was the only one in ICU with a bottle of wine on his night table. So it was a very generic way of treatment. And I vowed that if he lived, because we didn't think he would at that time, we would do something about it. I was appalled that there was no information, no help. So I kept my promise, and a year later, we had eight people who came, you know, through, oh, I heard about this one, that one kind of situation, and we met in our home, and what I thought would be a very nice support group and get together and discuss ailments and feelings, etc., turned into a big international organization. We have 190 chapters in 47 countries. We do research. We're all over the world, and we're huge. I can't believe it myself, so very proud of what we've done. And Canada was one of our first international incorporated organizations part. And we made sure that everything was done according to, you know, your laws. So we're very proud. We've had a great relationship with them.
So for those who might not be as familiar with the syndrome, can you tell me a little bit about how it affects a person?
Sure. This is Lisa. Guillain-Barré is a situation where we don't know all of the exact triggers and why the immune system responds the way it does. But typically, 2 to 4 weeks after some type of bacterial or viral infection, there's an immune response where instead of the immune system attacking the virus, it attacks itself. And it does that by attacking the covering of the nerves in the peripheral nerves, and that's called the myelin sheath. So when the myelin sheath is damaged, the nerves can't speak to the muscles properly, and that causes this weakness and eventually can cause paralysis. So it's a disease of the peripheral nervous system, not the central nervous system. And it usually starts in the feet and works its way up the body. So it ascends up the body, and then it descends as you recover in the same order. But once the symptoms start with Guillain-Barré, they continue very, very rapidly, and it can become very acute because as this condition works its way up the body, it can also affect the muscles that are working the respiratory system. So it's usually an ICU admission because oftentimes patients are put on respirators until their system's able to function on its own.
You know, Guillain-Barré is a rare neurologic condition. and it only affects 1 to 2 in every 100,000. And it's a very curious thing. It's the only reversible neurologic disorder. But the kicker is you don't know how sick you're going to get, how long that will take, what will come back, how long that will come take to come back. So it's curious, and there's we don't know why it happened. I'm going to ask you something. Are you allergic to bee stings?
I don't believe I am. But
okay, well, I am. And if we were both stung by the same bee, I would get a terrible reaction, and you would probably just brush it off. Well, what's in my immune system that would make me react to that? And that's the $64 question we have with Guillain-Barré syndrome. Why do some people get it?
And some people don't. So there's a lot of research being done, and the one very, very promising and encouraging piece of this is that in 7,000 rare diseases, there's only 5% of those 7,000 rare diseases that have a therapy, and we do. So not the case with Estelle's husband when he was diagnosed 40 years ago, but in today's world, there's a human-donated plasma product called immune globulin, and patients are given this early on, and it helps shorten the length of the disease developing and progressing. There's another treatment called plasmapheresis, where people are actually hooked up to sort of a transfusion-type machine in a hospital setting that removes sort of the bad plasma, if you will, out of the body and puts the good plasma back in.
So because of the efforts of the foundation, we're able to bring these treatments. And, of course, there's always they're using a chemo drug in conjunction with it. It depends where they are and what kind of research they're doing. But we're so proud that we have been able to bring treatments to our patients.
So I'm wondering, you recently said there was an announcement for the foundation that they had achieved something rather unique. Tell me a little bit about that.
So we have been accepted to be a member of the National Health Council. So this is, only a certain number of health organizations, certainly small rare disease communities like ours, are accepted into this program because there are 30-some-odd standards of practice that need to be adhered to. And it's everything from, best practices for board setup, all kinds of legal issues that have to be adhered to for really its best practices running a nonprofit. And we do adhere to those. So it's really a great partnership, if you will. But I would highlight another designation that we have is that we are a 4-star charity navigator organization. So that's also quite an accomplishment. And we're very, very proud of that as well. So that has to do with the governance around our fundraising and how we handle our books. Of course, as a nonprofit, all of our bookkeeping must be made public information, and we're very proud that Charity Navigator has designated us with their highest
ranking,
which is 4 stars. And we've been a 4-star member for 7 years, I believe. Yeah. So that's really quite an accomplishment. If you look at how they evaluate all the organizations, they look at the financial statements and the 990s, which is all available on our website.
So can you tell me a little bit about how the foundation serves its client base?
Sure. So we are very committed to 4 mission pillars that really define everything we do, and that is to provide support and education, engage in research, and engage in advocacy for these conditions. So on the support side, we have maintain a robust website. We run a quarterly newsletter. We have a huge volunteer base that hosts chapter support group meetings all over the world. And we also have an amazing volunteer medical advisory board that is global. So this is a group of neurologists primarily who are available for free physician-to-physician consultations. They answer questions all day long. They provide material for our newsletters. They speak at our support group meetings. They update our website with relevant information, clinical trials, cutting edge research, that kind of thing. We are able to, there are a lot of opportunities for patients to engage with us. We have a very strong social media presence. We have a walk program around the country where friends and family come together around a patient, and it's really sort of a day of celebration for a patient. And it's, we designed it as a fundraiser, but it's really become more than anything a time for community building and for patients to connect with one another. And what we found in the rare disease community is one of the most sort of effective healing tools is for patients to talk to each other. So I really look at our job as to provide spaces for that to happen. But we also have very large educational events. Every other year we have a large patient symposium where we have 600 patients and families come together for 2 days of connecting, education, information, really kind of celebration together. And in the off years, we have 4 or 5 one-day conferences where we move around the country to bring the programming more local.
And Lisa, let's remind the audience that we have 40-some centers of excellence, which is really an outstanding accomplishment. These centers of excellence have been thoroughly vetted by our medical advisory board, and we can guarantee proper diagnosis and proper treatment for those who do not have it available in their local communities.
That's great to add, Estelle. And they also, the Centers of Excellence, as well as us, have designed a patient registry launched last year. In less than 12 months, we have over 1,200 people enrolled in our patient registry. So this is an opportunity for people to contribute their story, contribute their journey, their experience, and really to help influence the lives of those in the future.
Like to thank you both for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec. Next segment of our show, we're going to hear a little bit about adaptive clothing from Izzy Calamari. So tell me a little bit about adaptive clothing.
Well, adaptive clothing is clothing that has been adapted to make it easier for someone to dress in and also more comfortable while they're wearing it. And for people that are wheelchair users, the clothing, like my clothing, is cut to follow the line of a seated person. So it's, again, more comfortable, often with pants, like when we sit down, they kind of cut into our gut and they ride down at the back. And our pants don't do that. They're more comfortable when you're sitting and they don't dig into you or ride down at the back.
So I'm guessing there would be some designs for those who have limited dexterity or harder time putting something on?
Mm-hmm. So for limited dexterity, we have different solutions. We put magnets in our coats in place of buttons. So magnets, just once they get close, they just clip together. So that makes it a lot easier. We also have these tabs on our pants that help you pull your pants up. So you just have to kind of cup your fingers, your hand through the tabs and pull up. And so you don't have to grip. We also have pulls on our zippers, on our zipper pulls. So it's just like a loop that you can put your finger through and then pull your zipper up or down just with your finger, again, so you don't have to grip.
So how does the disability community respond to knowing that these adaptations exist, that you can create something that's workable for them?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the response is always really positive because it does make things easier for them, and we try to create clothing that looks, you know, pretty standard and just like everybody else's clothes. So it doesn't stand out. It doesn't look medical. It doesn't look like it was meant for an older person living in long-term care. It's very trendy and stylish, and, you know, that just helps with, you know, just blending in and looking like everybody else when it comes to clothes.
So are there any challenges in designing or putting it all together?
Well, I've been doing it for a very long time. And so initially, it was challenging. It was, you know, hard to figure out what I needed to do with the pattern draft and to understand what needs to be adjusted, especially for people that use a wheelchair and for our bodies, what happens when we sit down. Because everybody, you know, pretty well, we all sit down. We get up and down if we're not wheelchair users or someone with a disability. And, you know, we don't really think twice about it. And we don't realize that for someone who is a wheelchair user, that clothing can be very challenging if it's not designed for sitting long periods of time or all day. So also, if you can imagine wearing a long winter coat, even a parka, if you can't stand up to put on a parka or a coat, you're just going to end up with a big puddle around your waist if you can't stand up to tuck it underneath you, which a lot of people cannot do. So they just, coats are just not an option for people that use a wheelchair when they're cut and produced in a standard way. But our coats are cut to follow the line of a seated person, so you are able to put them on while seated and your lap is covered. Often people just end up buying short jackets, like a bomber jacket or something, because they can put that on while they're sitting and they don't need to tuck it underneath them. But what ends up happening in the wintertime or during the rain is that their thighs get all rained on or snowed on. They get very cold. And it takes a long time for, especially someone who's paralyzed, to warm up after coming in from the cold when their lap is not protected. And it can take hours for someone to warm up.
So do you have anything specifically for someone with something like a vision impairment?
I don't. That's not an area that I've gotten into so far. But in the future, you know, I do want to extend our product range and offer, you know, more than I do now.
So what message would you send to the community about the need for clothing to take disabilities into consideration?
To the disabled community?
Just in general.
Well, adaptive clothing is definitely something that can improve one's life if it's something that they could benefit from. You know, I think often, too, people hesitate to even give it a try because they think it's clinical or medical or, you know, and it's not. And, you know, once people do take that leap and give it a try, they're kind of believers after that. So I would say give it a go, and it'll make things better for you.
Like to thank you for taking time out to do this, but if
no
you can
problem
stay,
I appreciate you reaching out.
Of course, you can stay on the line for a sec. That'd be great.
Sure.
HandyLink will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
Whether you're hosting friends for a night in, exploring new restaurants and breweries in town, or going out to your favorite watering hole, please drink responsibly. Designate a sober driver. Call a taxi, a friend, or just stay over. Thank you for always driving sober. A message from Arrive Alive, Drive Sober.
Welcome back to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that provides recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, we heard from Estelle Benson and her associate Laura from the GBS Foundation, and from Izzy Calmieri about adaptive clothing. In this segment of our show, we'll hear from Rick McDonald. So recently I saw a video of you being out on the snow. Can you tell me a little bit about what led you out there?
A friend of mine is an avid skier, and he's much younger than me. He's in his mid-20s. I'm 59. And he's been asking me to come out since January to try out sit skiing. So I'm a C5-6 quadriplegic, so I thought, well, it's going to be a little scary, but I went out and tried it, and it was an exhilarating experience sitting on that ski going down the slopes.
So can you tell me a little bit about the adaptations in a sit ski?
I thought at first it was going to be more like a toboggan, and I wasn't that interested in tobogganing down a slope. But the sit ski has two skis underneath it, and they're almost side by side. And then on the outside at the front, it has two kind of half skis, and they're up about 3 or 4 inches, and you lean right to left to control the motion of the sit ski. So it really is like, you know, snow plowing when you are learning how to ski. It's a lot of fun.
So change gears a little bit. In our last interview, I had wanted to ask a little bit about the work you do, and I was hoping you could share.
Right. So I'm retired from IBM Canada. I worked there for 30 years, and I retired. And now what I'm doing is teaching accessibility awareness or disability awareness to taxi cab and Uber drivers and Lyft drivers for Centennial College. So the first day is theory, and for the second day we do hands-on. We bring in a wheelchair accessible vehicle, and we practice strapping the wheelchair in and tying it down.
So what are some of the challenges in teaching taxi and Uber drivers and how to correctly deal with a person with a disability?
Probably one of the biggest challenges is we want to do some testing at the end of the day. And most of the taxi and Uber drivers that I've had so far are ESL, English as a second language. So the language is sometimes one of the obstacles. But I find when we take our time and we sit together, it all works out in the end. I've been pleased with the students that I've had. I've met people from all around the world, and it's really interesting to meet some of these people who are coming to Canada and trying to make a start and get some work going. And I think taxi cab Uber is a good option for them to do that.
So in your teaching work and just in terms of recreation, has there been any success story you'd like to share?
Well, I have met in my travels as a teacher, sometimes, like I drive an old, it's a hot rod, it's a 1951 Chevy Suburban, so it's often breaking down, so I have had a need to call a taxi cab or Uber drivers, and I've met two or three of my students along the way, and they've thanked me, and I've thanked them, and it's been a great experience to see that they're being like successful in that business and they're really pleased with it.
So if you could send any message to the community about the need for this understanding and this sense of equality in dealing with a person with a disability, what would you say?
I would start by saying that someone who has a disability like similar to mine, like I'm a spinal cord injured person, like I'm just like you, and I'm just sitting in a wheelchair, but I'm exactly like you. And at any moment, hopefully not, but at any moment, you could be like me. So we need to be kinder to people. We need to understand people better, and regardless of the disability. Also, with aging, everybody is probably going to either become disabled themselves or they're going to experience a family member who has a disability. So it's good to be kinder with people around you.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Sure.
My friends, life is all about adaptation. It's all about seeing the possible. I mean, to have a quadriplegic person teaching taxi drivers and Uber drivers on the correct way to respond to a person with a disability, some people would look and take the backwards notion of you're not in a position to be driving. That's just outdated thinking. I mean, fact is, who better can speak to these matters than someone affected by them? Society likes to look at the problems. They like to look and they like to say, oh, the poor disabled person, we better fix that. We're not going to ask them what they really need, what really works for them. We're going to assume they need A, B, and C. And that sort of thinking led to the words, nothing about us without us. The fact is, we can't properly address anything unless we understand the nature of it. We can't really understand the mentality and the day-to-day needs of a person with a disability unless we have those conversations, unless we ask those questions, unless we say, gee, have you tried this before? Does it work? Does it not work? For Rick, getting out there and trying a sit-ski for the first time sounds pretty adventurous. Sounds exhilarating, to be honest. I mean, too many times a person with an acquired disability will hesitate to get out there and enjoy all of what the world has to offer. A hesitation, a perceived notion that they've somehow become more fragile. It's a very pervasive thought. However, not too many of them. Just take the chance. Live for that strength that they have shown in dealing with the circumstances of life. Fact is, we all have a great strength within us, whether we have a disability or not. We don't know what's possible till we get out there and let ourselves experience the moment. Yeah, it'd be easier to say this is impossible and simply live under that precept. You know what happens then, my friends? Progress simply stops. People just say, I've been given one answer. I'm not going to ask any questions. I'm not going to learn. I'm not going to grow. I'm not going to research. Simple stagnation is the end result when people accept what they have been spoon-fed. It's very true for the patient who was given a 0% chance of survival and has made it 20 years anyway, or for the person who's been told they'd never have kids and now has 4 or 5. If they had simply lived with that looming shadow that says, it's impossible, it can't be done, the world would be a much worse place for it. Because once a wall of illusion has been shattered by a person with a disability and for those who would follow, that wall cannot be rebuilt. We're not ostriches, people. We can't just stick our heads in the sand and pretend the world's going to go away. Truth is, progress is made with bravery, with challenging the establishment, with challenging the idea that this is as far as we can go in terms of progress, and no farther. It's when somebody says, I have an idea, I think it could work, maybe it sounds a little out there, but I'm going to try to adapt the world to make it work for me and for others who can very likely benefit by what I'm doing. It's by those people that knowledge is gained, answers given. I mean, very simple terms. One thing doesn't work, try something else. If you're determined enough, you will find a way to succeed at the things you love, the things you want to do in this world. But really, the path is for each of us to chart, because only within ourselves do we know what we want to do and what we just want to see happen with the world. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you we're all equal, so get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me you've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.